content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, from which I'll be reading, is dated September 4, 2023. Bordered in red, as usual. The front cover has a narrow white inner border. It indicates our 100th year in the upper right-hand corner, as if it's a thumbprint page-turning place. Time is in large, bold, capital letters, white, superimposed upon blue, with clouds in this blue sky. Does this ride never end? Is the subtitle for the illustration, which is a roller coaster, decorated in red, white, and blue, stylized American flag motif. Donald Trump is in the front seat, waving and yelling and with his hair blowing and his necktie blowing, and behind him, numerous other people in this illustration are still included. Vice President Mike Pence, Nikki Haley is there, Chris Christie, and other people whose names I cannot remember just now. None of them is captioned. So in this edition, I'll begin with the article entitled 2030, The Healing Sea, The Oceans. In a quest to preserve the zones that let oceans thrive, ecologist Enrique Sala, S-A-L-A, heads for the South Pacific, by Aaron Baker. There's a very colorful two-page photo spread here introducing this article. It's in shades of blues and greens. There's a scuba diver one level deep in the ocean, and that person is surrounded. The person's wearing a blue dive suit, but the person is surrounded by the greens of the ocean. And the caption for this two-page photo spread is, Sala, founder of Pristine Seas, explores a Palau reef in 2014. The photograph is by Manu San Felix, National Geographic, Pristine Seas. Enrique Sala, marine ecologist, conservationist, and ocean advocate, is standing under a life-size replica of a northern Atlantic right whale at the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C. And the air outside is smudged with wildfire smoke drifting down from Canada. It is not surprising Sala wants to talk about the smoke or about whales. Their poop, however, is an unexpected twist. According to Sala, whale excrement, or more precisely the lack of it, has a role to play in the choking miasma that has forced my interview with one of the world's foremost ocean explorers indoors instead of out on a boat. It may seem like a stretch, the kind that relegates environmentalists deep into woo-woo territory, but as our conversation unfolds, it starts making sense. Whale poop fertilizes ocean plankton. The plankton reproduces rapidly, absorbing carbon dioxide as it photosynthesizes sunlight. Eventually, it sinks to the sea floor, trapping the planet-warming gas in layers of sediment. Fewer whales means less plankton sequestering CO2, leaving more in the atmosphere. That means more of the heat driving the wildfires, that have smoked out much of North America. Suddenly, we are seeing that the impacts of climate change are not something that's going to be suffered by somebody else, says Sala. It is here. And so it is. In the wildfires, heat waves, and floods that have made the weather of summer 2023 some of the most extreme on record. Greater biodiversity, whether it's found in the ocean's whale populations or the old-growth forests that also store carbon, can help mitigate the effect of burning fossil fuels much more cheaply than any new technology, he says. The more nature we have, the more nature will be able to absorb our impacts. Sala's links between healthy ocean ecosystems and human benefits like carbon sequestration are backed up by science that he has either committed to memory or conducted himself. But it is the ability to break scientific complexity into simple concepts that even landlubbers can comprehend that makes him so effective as an ocean advocate, helping rally global governments to commit to protecting 30% of their coastlines and ocean territories by 2030. That's 2030. His Pristine Seas project, sponsored by the National Geographic Society, has identified dozens of the ocean's most biodiverse hot spots in an effort to call for their protection. Already he's managed to get 2.5 million square miles, 6.5 million square kilometers of coastline and ocean set aside in 26 marine protected areas, MPAs, an expanse twice the size of India, where fishing, dumping, mining, and other destructive industries are prohibited. May 24, Pristine Seas scientific research ship, the EV Argo, lifted anchor for its most ambitious undertaking yet, a five-year expedition to the remote tropical Pacific, where Sala plans not only to chart the world's biggest ocean from its unplumbed depths to its more familiar shores, but also to document the complex links between marine ecosystems and the lives they support on land in order to build a case for their conservation. The ocean needs that help more than ever. The morning of our meeting, the European Climate Monitoring Agency reported May 2023 had seen the highest ocean temperatures on record, increasing ocean acidity, weakening marine ecosystems, forcing coral polyps to expel their colorful symbiotic zooanthellae algae in a near-death phenomena called bleaching. By the end of July, waters off the coast of Florida had reached jacuzzi temperatures, and volunteers were racing to transfer fragile coral sprouts to indoor aquariums before they cooked to death. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, N-O-A-A, about 40% of the world's oceans are currently experiencing a marine heat wave, with as much as 50% forecast in September. The ocean has already absorbed more than 90% of the planet's greenhouse gas-fueled warming, explains Sala. But it will not be able to absorb our impacts for much longer without serious consequences. The havoc wreaked on coral reefs destroys habitats that nurse, nourish, or shelter a quarter of all marine life, including the fish that provide critical protein and income to a billion people around the world. Goods and services provided by reefs in the form of tourism, shoreline protection, food, and fisheries are valued at $2.7 trillion a year. The economic consequences of reef loss are grim and looming ever closer, says Sala. A 2 degrees centigrade or higher rise in average global temperatures since humans started burning fossil fuels for energy would be enough to wipe out an estimated 99% of existing coral reefs. The month of July already averaged 1.5 degrees centigrade. I find that I am rarely invited back to dinner parties, he deadpans. Still, says Sala, there is hope. His research has proved again and again that given the space to recover undisturbed from human exploitation, nature can bounce back. A marine protected area cannot make that water cooler, cannot protect from warming, but what we know is that fully protected areas are more resilient. He has watched pristine reef systems, bleached white by marine heat waves, recover within 5 years, but only when they have their full cohort of predators like sharks, along with the smaller inhabitants they prey upon. A reef, he says, is not just made up of coral. It is a delicately balanced ecosystem that includes bacteria, algae, plants, clams, crabs, urchins, herbivores, and the carnivores that keep them all in check. Take one element out and the entire system becomes unsustainable. You board a plane and the pilot informs you 5 screws are missing, but you don't know from where. Would you still fly? He asks. Sala's solution for protecting the ocean from rising heat is simple. Identify the richest areas of biodiversity and protect them from human intervention. Left alone, the resulting abundance will eventually spill over into unprotected zones, stocking new areas with fish that can be harvested for human consumption, while allowing for the evolution of genetic adaptation to a changing climate. MPAs, says Sala, are like an interest-bearing savings account. As long as you don't touch the principal, you can live off the interest. The only way to get more from the ocean is to have more life in the ocean, says Sala. And the only way to have more marine life is to set some places aside so it can thrive. It is as simple as this. As an avid snorkeler, growing up close to the near barren waters of Spain's Costa Brava, Sala always assumed the lush underwater gardens of his favorite Jacques Cousteau documentaries could be found only in faraway tropical paradises. A chance scuba lesson in the Medas Islands Marine Park, one of Spain's first MPAs, taught him the Mediterranean could be just as much an underwater wonderland when it was protected from the region's industrial fishing fleets. Everything that was missing from the sea of my childhood was there, he recalls. The grouper, the sea bass, the scorpion fish, octopus, sea bream. That epiphany sparked an interest in marine conservation, and with a PhD in ecology, he went on to help establish the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation in 2000 at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. But despite his tenured position, generous research grants, and the opportunity to work with the best ocean scientists in the world, he felt something was missing. The places that I was studying were falling under the force of the relentless human sledgehammer, he wrote in his 2020 memoir, The Nature of Nature, Why We Need the Wild. Corals and seagrasses were dying everywhere, and fish were being taken out of the water faster than they could reproduce. Lush underwater gardens full of large animals were being turned into dead reefs, overgrown by brown algae and murky jellyfish dystopias. I realized all I was doing was writing the obituary of ocean life, He felt, he says, like a doctor telling his patient how they would die without offering a cure, so he quit and went in search of one. Pristine Seas was inspired by a National Geographic story about an explorer who trekked across Central Africa and persuaded the president of Gabon to create a chain of national parks to protect the region's wildlife. Sala wondered if the same could be done for the oceans. In 2007, Sala approached the National Geographic Society with a proposal to combine exploration, research, policy, and documentary film to build a case for local governments to establish national marine protected areas. He envisioned pristine seas as a kind of scientific SWAT team, refining our understanding of ocean life by sending divers, submersibles, cameras into waters previously unplumbed by research, and working with economists, ecologists, and climate scientists to calculate the value of preserving what they found. Since 2008, the program has conducted 38 expeditions, produced 30 documentaries, published more than 250 peer-reviewed studies that have upended long-held assumptions about marine ecosystems, including the power of highly protected areas to rapidly restore depleted fish, coral reefs, and kelp forests in adjacent waters. In a 2021 paper for Nature, Sala demonstrated that protecting 30% of the ocean would also deliver benefits for commercial fisheries and carbon sequestration. He identified key areas that, if protected, would provide the most benefit in terms of nature conservation, food production, and climate mitigation, a kind of more bang for your protection buck checklist that he's now trying to persuade local governments to implement. Overall, Pristine Seas has helped midwife a total of 26 MPAs into existence, raising the percentage of protected ocean from 1% to 8%. That is still significantly less than the 30% scientists say is necessary to protect ocean biodiversity. Sala visibly flinches when reminded of that shortfall and acknowledges the pressures piling up since he started 15 years ago, from a quadrupling of plastic waste to higher temperatures and increased fishing pressures. "Now I'm working on the cure, but the patient's getting worse and worse," he concedes. "We fixed the lungs, but oh, now there's something wrong with the liver. Oh, and now there's a blood clot. So yeah, it is a Sisyphean task, but that is what makes me keep going. I do not see a bigger purpose than working to save life on Earth." In a 2009 expedition to Kiribati's Southern Line Islands, a chain of uninhabited atolls, 1,800 miles southwest of Hawaii, Sala found reefs that had never seen pressure from commercial fisheries, a thriving coral jungle full of large fish. By then, or before then, he says, scientists had no idea what pristine reefs looked like. In 2015 and 2016, disaster struck. A marine heat wave triggered coral bleaching in more than half the reef. Sala thought he was witnessing the destruction of one of the ocean's last intact coral colonies, but a return visit in 2022 demonstrated a miraculous recovery. Coral was growing back, and the fish were as plentiful as they'd ever been. "It recovered like a phoenix," says Sala. Documenting the reef's recovery was not enough. Sala wanted to understand why those corals survived the heat when so many other reefs did not, and how that recovery could be replicated elsewhere. Sala theorized small grazing fish had kept the bleached coral free of the brown algae that usually takes over, enabling the coral polyps to regain their zooxanthella and start growing again. In June, pristine seas returned to the area of one of the first stops of its new Pacific expedition, in part to test Sala's hypothesis. Was it the presence of large numbers of fish, or because larvae from other less affected corals were able to take root among the ruins? Had the surviving corals evolved some sort of heat resistance? If we believe that high protection is a key ingredient for coral resilience, we need the data, he says. One of the most effective components of Sala's pristine seas expeditions is the opportunity to offer a front row seat for the ocean's underwater marvels to people who can make a difference. We take presidents, ministers with us. They come out of the submarine saying, "This was the most transformative experience of my life," says Sala. Once they make the emotional connection, Sala presents them with the economic case for protection and the policy proposals that help them sell it to their people. After going out with Pristine Seas in 2022, then Colombian President Iván Duque more than doubled the country's marine protected areas, bringing it within reach of the 30% goal, and joining forces with regional neighbors, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Panama, to establish the largest protected marine zone in the Western Hemisphere, if not the world. It is this combination of action-oriented research and passionate advocacy that has enabled Sala to be so effective, says Jennifer Jacquet, a fisheries researcher and visiting professor of environmental science at the University of Miami, who has co-authored papers with Sala. He is someone who understands that advances in science are incremental, and that actually the most urgent problems are social ones that require politics and policies and advocacy, things that many scientists do not feel comfortable with. Equally at ease slipping into a wetsuit on the deck of the EV Argo, as he is networking in a shirt and tie at Davos, Sala has a passion that's infectious and incredibly effective at captivating the people who have the most power to protect our oceans, government leaders. Jane Lubchenco, a marine ecologist who led NOAA from 2009 to 2013 and a co-author on the Nature MPA paper, recalls watching him present his early findings to a panel of Norwegian lawmakers in 2018 to help rally support for a global commitment to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030. Going in, says Lubchenco, they were dead set against it, convinced that MPAs would harm the country's lucrative fishing industry. But as Sala spoke, you could feel the tone of the room change, she says. Before, they had been told that they had to choose between fisheries and biodiversity, or between climate change benefits and food security. His message was that if you use science to pay attention to where these hot spots are, you can actually maximize all. Nobel Foundation Executive Director Vidar Helgesen, as Norway's then Minister of Climate and the Environment, had invited Sala to present. Henrik's impressive presentation, and not least his case that protection actually increases fishery volumes, served to strengthen the hand of those supporting protection and weaken the resistance of others, he says. Norway went on to support the 30% target. And as chair of the high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy, encourages other countries, including fishing stalwart Japan, to follow suit. More than advocacy, more than science, Sala's key sales point for ocean protection is hope. As fish stocks dwindle and ocean temperatures rise, Sala offers a solution that does not even require a sacrifice, just an adjustment. It is a potent antidote to the endless parade of doomsday scenarios that dominate today's climate conversations, says Lubchenco, offering an option to protect and restore the vibrancy of ocean ecosystems is very attractive because people can actually see there is something they can do. Could such a policy be applied to the whole of the Mediterranean? Sala pauses in front of the exhibit of sea fan coral, a species that's all but gone from his old snorkeling grounds off the coast of Spain. His face flickers with emotion as he imagines what a protected Mediterranean would look like. Before you get in the water, you will see monk seals on the beach, he says. There would be kelp forests 60 meters deep, lots of fish, including very large groupers, starfish, and shrimp, and lots of lobsters, and octopuses. More of everything, he whispers, before anchoring himself back into reality. The Mediterranean of the future is not going to be like the Mediterranean of the past. For one, it's warmer than it used to be, and invasive species have made it a permanent home. But we can still make sure it's better than it is now. We just have to leave enough of it alone. That article The Healing Sea was written by Aaron Baker, with reporting by Simone Shaw. Turning to Time Off, The New Romantics by Judy Berman. A decade after 50 Shades, pop culture romance has become alarmingly wholesome. Once upon a time, in a universe much like our own, the United States of America had a female president with a son named Alex Claremont Diaz. When Alex met Henry, a British prince, it was mutual rancor at first sight. Down-to-earth Alex thought Henry a snob, and haughty Henry thought Alex an ill-mannered commoner. This antipathy escalated into an international incident that climaxed in a giant cake toppling and burying them under layers of fluffy icing. Fast forward through a handful of publicity stunts designed to sell the public on their friendship, and the two young men are hopelessly, hornily in love. But neither is openly queer. If you're worried this is all destined to end in heartbreak and geopolitical catastrophe, then you probably are not familiar with Casey McQuiston, who dreamed up the scenario in their hit 2019 novel Red, White, and Royal Blue. Now back on bestseller lists in anticipation of a frothy new adaptation on Prime Video, Royal Blue is emblematic of a new generation of love story that has conquered pop culture. I call it wholesome romance. I'm stopping here to remind listeners that this article was published in September of 2023. Judy Berman is the author. Returning to the text, decorated with cute illustrations, wholesome romance covers leap out from bookstore displays in gummy candy hues. Whether Shell does contemporary romance, YA, or new adult, these buoyant books take place in more idyllic versions of our reality, full of gentle humor and happy endings. The stakes are low, the people kind, the sex scenes vanilla, and the books like Heartstopper, based on Alice Oseman's comic, which just dropped its second season on Netflix, and Amazon's The Summer I Turned Pretty, whose author Jenny Hahn's YA romances have fueled 3 movies and 2 TV series since 2018, are getting snapped up by Hollywood. The sensibility has breached the romance novel to rom-com pipeline and spilled over into literary fiction, reality TV, podcasts. unassuming as they may be. The titles represent a dramatic shift in the fantasy lives of their mostly female audience. The multi-platform romance and adjacent juggernauts of the recent past, from Twilight and The Fault in Our Stars to 50 Shades of Grey, seduced fans with blood-sucking dreamboats, BDSM billionaires, and terminally ill teens. Now, when we immerse ourselves in a love story, fewer of us seem to be seeking that frisson of danger. What has become more exotic and thus more desirable is comfort, safety, stability. That our collective daydreams now seem so healthy and achievable is not necessarily a sign of progress. No story epitomizes this new sensibility like Beach Read, the breakthrough novel by erstwhile YA author Emily Henry. Published 2 months into COVID lockdown, the book hinges on the classic rom-com trope of enemies to lovers. After the sudden death of her father and a bad breakup, romance writer January Andrews moves into the secret beach house that her seemingly perfect dad used for an affair. She's got all summer to deliver a new manuscript, but can no longer bear to write tidy love stories. Then she realizes her next-door neighbor is an old college rival who's grown up to be an acclaimed literary novelist. They fall in love, brought together by the challenge to swap genre for the summer. Beach Read, like Henry's subsequent novels, including 2023's Happy Place, now in its fourth month on bestseller lists, has all the elements of a comforting romance. The characters are normal humans, albeit attractive ones with glamorous careers, who have familiar problems. The reader's surrogate female narrator is independent and outspoken. The setting, a Michigan beach town, is beautiful, but not ostentatious. The ratio of witty banter to explicit lovemaking is high. Henry and many of her peers play to their audience by writing the stories they treasure into a book. There's a whole lot of subgenre of romance novels about people who love to read and write, including Henry's book lovers. Like Laura Jean and Hans, to all the boys I've loved before, January was a romance reader first. She discovered the genre when she picked up a paperback in the waiting room of her cancer-stricken mom's radiologist. Mom's first diagnosis taught me that love was an escape rope, she recalls, but it was her second diagnosis that taught me love could be a life vest when you were drowning. That life raft is a booming business. After a lockdown bump, and as the genre continues to trend in the corner of TikTok known as Book Talk, Publishers Weekly reported a precipitous 52.4% increase in romance book sales in 2022. This summer, or this past summer, romances by Hannah Grace, Ollie Hazelwood, Anne Napolitano, Taylor Jenkins Reid, and publishing powerhouse Colleen Hoover dominated the bestseller lists. A new streaming adaptation of a wholesome romance seems to pop up weekly, from Netflix's take on Catherine Center's novel Happiness for Beginners, whose premise is more or less wild as a rom-com, to Paramount Plus's Love in Taipei, a breezy new adult romance based on a YA novel by Abigail Hing Wen. But the wholesome romance sensibility isn't just a sales trend within an isolated niche, nor is it simply the latest incarnation of the rom-com, which both entails a more specific format and allows for more variation in tone. It is about our society's shifting orientation toward romance, regardless of genre. The yearning for grounded love stories about regular, well-intentioned people with relatable goals, marriage, professional achievement, maybe kids, has become evident across narrative art forms, from highbrow novels to lowbrow reality TV. Compare the Netflix smash Love is Blind with the waning grand dame of dating shows, The Bachelor. While the latter is a glittering fairy tale of courtship, the former throws a couple dozen millennials into isolated pods where they seek potential mates sight unseen. Before they can gaze deep into each other's eyes, cast members establish compatibility by comparing values, ambitions, religious beliefs, desires to procreate, vicarious indulgence in the minutiae of other people's relationships is a trendlet unto itself. Showtime's Couples Therapy and Esther Perel's hit podcast, Where Should We Begin?, are two voyeuristic options. In this year's breakout indie romance, Celine Song's Past Lives, a young woman must choose between a childhood friend from Korea and the American man she married. In the end, she makes the safe decision. Some of the biggest recent literary novels have riffed on the tropes of the wholesome romance. Irish author Sally Rooney became an international sensation with books that contrast romance and friendship with the everyday misery of 21st century capitalism, and posit love as an imperfect refuge. Rooney's Normal People and Conversations with Friends were swiftly adapted into Hulu miniseries. The genre-hopping Nigerian writer Akwaeke Emezi articulates this idea in their acclaimed 2022 romance, You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty. I think we're just figuring out how to survive a world on fire, that it's okay to be alive, says Emesi's heroine, Faye. A young widow, she witnessed her husband's car crash death and has denied herself love and pleasure since. But Faye is also an avatar for anyone struggling to feel truly alive at a time when COVID and war and opioids and climate crisis makes us all, if we are lucky enough to survive, witnesses to large-scale death. Romance, like sci-fi and fantasy, has always promised an escape from reality. But reality has rarely felt as chaotic as it has since the norm-shattering election of Donald Trump and a deadly pandemic, as violent backlash to the movement for Black Lives, feminism, and LGBTQ liberation accelerates. Romance once offered audiences an escape from daily doldrums by exploiting extremes of emotion and experience in what were essentially adventure stories. It was not until the sexual revolution had swept through youth culture that romance novels got explicit about sexuality. The so-called bodice ripper was born in 1972 with Kathleen E. Woodywiss's The Flame and the Flower, which follows an 18th-century maiden who falls for a ship captain who kidnaps and ravages her. Erica Jong's feminist sex romp Fear of Flying and Bernardo Bertolucci's embattled Last Tango in Paris followed. Around the same time, Deep Throat took porn movies mainstream. By the Reagan 80s and the Clinton 90s, as economic prosperity helped cloister middle America from the tragic fallout of epidemics like AIDS and crack, erotic thrillers from Body Heat to Cruising needled the collective subconscious about infidelity, queerness, female empowerment. The blockbuster romance franchises of the early 21st century, Twilight and 50 Shades, put regular girls at the mercy of powerful men who hurt them. While Twilight traced its roots to the brooding romances of the Brontes, wholesome romance has more in common with Jane Austen's light, witty novels of smart women and the difficult men who love them, which might explain why Shondaland's Regency romance, Bridgerton, based on Julia Quinn's blockbuster books, became a phenomenon when it debuted on Netflix over the lonely pandemic holidays of 2020, and why writer-star Joel Kim Booster used Pride and Prejudice as a guide for his splashy gay romance, Fire Island, in 2022. More than anything, though, this wholesome romance moment, reminds me of the vogue for screwball comedies in the 1930s. With the Great Depression raging, Americans scrounged pennies to watch beautiful people flirt. The sequins, nightclubs, and deco roadsters represented a lifestyle that suddenly no longer seemed attainable to the salaried masses. The characters in Netflix's Heartstopper are teenagers wise beyond their years. One night, closeted rugby star Nick Kit Connor apologizes for failing to come out as bisexual at a party when he had promised Charlie, his openly gay boyfriend, he would do so. Charlie's response, that he doesn't owe his coming out to anyone, sounds like the kind of thing a person who had been through therapy would say. But this sort of talk is a lingua franca for the sensitive teens and young adults who populate these romances. Mental health is central to the wholesome romance's fantasy of safety, as manifested in relationships built on emotional intimacy. Like Charlie, who once faced bullying after being outed, many of the protagonists in this otherwise cheery subgenre have trauma in their past. This is where these stories overlap with Hoover's wildly popular darker romances. In her biggest hit, It Ends With Us, flower shop owner Lily meets irresistible Lothario Ryle hours after her abusive father's funeral. But when Ryle becomes violent, she finds the courage to leave. Instead of eroticizing abuse, as early Body Rippers did, Hoover's novel, soon to be a movie starring Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, is built around the dream of breaking a destructive cycle, even if its compassionate portrait of Ryle can come worryingly close to justifying his behavior. Hoover notwithstanding, many of these romance narratives also diverge from the straightness and whiteness that have suffused the vast majority of mainstream romances in the past. In the wholesome romance, love is not just a refuge from old trauma or contemporary cataclysms. It is also a safe space for characters and audiences who regularly experience sexism or racism or homophobia. Published midway through Trump's term, Red, White, and Royal Blue projects that same sense of security into the political sphere, imagining a Democratic female president, along with a black female British prime minister who loves her queer son. In many ways, the wholesome romance is an encouraging trend, but I am not convinced it says anything positive about the state of the world. Escapism is not meant to be rational. On the contrary, it's a means of imagining the impossible. It is no coincidence that 50 years ago, the powerful gains of the women's movement, culminating in Roe v. Wade, coexisted with romances that often placed female characters in positions of powerlessness. What's taboo becomes titillating. Women who devoured the violent rape sagas of the 70s were not lining up to be sexually assaulted. Twilight fans did not actually want to have their bodies ripped asunder by a super strong fetus with a vampire for a father. That great recycling center that is American pop culture in the 21st century has inevitably endeavored to bring back the steamy, scary, kinky entertainment of generations past. Yet erotic thriller auteur Adrienne Lyne's 2022 comeback deep water was unintentionally funny more than exhilarating. Paramount Plus's attempt to reimagine Lyne's Fatal Attraction fell disastrously flat. On the heels of 5 years' worth of Me Too revelations, Hollywood's conflation of love with predation no longer seems so exotic. What we want instead are gentler, less stressful romances. And the more popular they become, the more that popularity looks like a red flag for society at large, and female audiences in particular. Why would anyone need to escape into a story where lifestyles are comfortable, relationships are respectful, women are financially independent, and mental health is paramount if that was already their reality, or even an achievable goal? It is not such a wholesome thought. Judy Berman wrote that article, The New Romantics. Next, a review, The Man Who Was Everything and Then Some, by Stephanie Zakarik. As a nation torn apart by, of all things, the perception that drag performers will corrupt our children, the time is right for a documentary about the Glitter King himself, Little Richard, a performer who broke all kinds of boundaries at a time when doing so could be life-threatening. Lisa Cortez's Little Richard, I Am Everything, which premiered at Sundance and made its television premiere on CNN September 4, tells the life story of a man who was born Richard Wayne Penniman in 1932, Macon, Georgia, the son of a minister and nightclub owner who disapproved of his son's flamboyance. But Cortez, using clips from Penniman's performances and appearances on TV talk shows, gives us something much more than your standard biographical documentary. She uses Penniman's story to map America's conflicted feelings about its own racial, religious, and sexual identity, and to celebrate the freedom he bestowed upon us, freedom that he wanted us to have, even if he sometimes did not allow himself to enjoy it. Penniman, one of 12 children born to a mother he adored, had always loved performing. In church, he tells us in voice over, they wouldn't let me sing that much because I wouldn't stop. His stern father knew the truth about his son's sexual orientation and made his life miserable. But as a teenager, Penniman found a haven in a Macon speakeasy called Ann's TikTok, and joined a touring circuit that allowed queer performers and marginalized audiences to flourish. In those early days, Penniman himself performed in drag, and it was not long before he had carved out an image for himself as wickedly handsome dazzler in sparkly suits, his hair a sky-high pompadour swoop, his pencil mustache adding a touch of old Hollywood elegance to what was an otherwise revolutionary and totally modern look. The original lyrics of Little Richard's first hit, the 1955 R&B showstopper Tutti Frutti, are essentially unprintable. As written, the song was an ebullient ode to a certain sexual practice. But even after the words were cleaned up, the song remained transcendent in the very dirtiness of its sound. It's one of the greatest anthems of unapologetic selfhood ever written, announcing Little Richard has arrived. When Penniman crowed about having invented rock and roll, and Cortez includes plenty of instances of his glorious, over-the-top braggadocio, he wasn't even bragging. Elvis Presley himself, knowing there was no contest, acknowledged Little Richard as the true king. Yet as wholly confident as Penniman was, he had his moments of self-doubt, and Cortez maps them out with compassion. In 1957, after suffering what he believed to be a near-death experience aboard a flight from Melbourne to Sydney, Penniman renounced his homosexuality, a state of being he'd always been open about, and decided to devote his life to God. But he could not stay away from his true calling forever. Eventually, he returned to the rock and roll flock, though over the years, until his death in 2020, he often struggled to reconcile his faith with his sexual orientation. That complexity, Cortez makes clear, is part of Little Richard's legacy. He was a child of God, always, taking whatever blessings came his way and passing them along to us, often in a shout, so raw and so joyous that there was never any risk of mistaking its true meaning. This next article, which is lengthy, will be abridged. Baja in the Balance, the Campaign to Preserve a Region and a Local Fishing Industry, by Jeffrey Kluger, photographs by Christina Mittermeier. It is a double-page photographic spread with blue, bright blue at the top and gray at the bottom. I believe the gray is the ocean. Well, no, I'll read the caption. A gray whale in the waters off Baja California. Once called devil fish and targeted by whalers, the animals now help drive the tourism industry. So it's a gray whale within a gray ocean. It is easy to spot the small family-owned fishing boats that ply the waters around Baja California, a peninsula 1,223 kilometers, 760 miles long, that represents the westernmost part of Mexico. There are 24,000 of the vessels, after all, and they spend much of their time at sea, as well they might, if the so-called artisanal fishermen are going to compete with the vastly larger industrial vessels that fish the same waters. The average artisanal boat measures 24 meters, 79 feet, from bow to stern, compared with the industrial vessels, which can easily exceed the length of a football field, at 130 meters, 427 feet. And the industrial vessels are equipped accordingly with nets that measure 600 meters, 1,968 feet across, and baited lines that may stretch 45 kilometers, 28 miles long. There is a huge level of injustice there, says Christina Mittermeier, a photographer, marine biologist, and co-founder of the U.S.-based ocean preservation group Sea Legacy, which is partnering with the Mexico-based group Beta Diversidad to address environmental and economic problems around Baja California. The industrial fishing fleet is owned by billionaires and subsidized by the government. The kind of mega fishing the industrial boats do leaves a huge environmental footprint. Up to 96% of the population of bluefin tuna in the region are gone, for example. For every 2.2 pounds of shrimp pulled from the ocean, there are more than 20 pounds of unwanted bycatch, mostly juveniles of various species. The nets drag along the bottom of the ocean, damaging the delicate ecosystem of the ocean floor and releasing the carbon that's sequestered in the sediment. It is not just the industrial fishing boats that are making a mess of these waters. It is tourists, too. Ecotourism generally has a benign sound to it, conjuring up images of respectful whale watchers looking for the great creatures from quiet boats idling at a distance. But things are not nearly so peaceable. Unregulated tourism affects species like whales, orcas, marlins, sea lions, and dolphins, thanks to overcrowding of boats with no permits, says Mario Gomez, president of Beta Diversidad. There can be 30 boats chasing one orca, says Mittermeier. I was in one of those boats 15 years ago. All of the whale sharks we saw had propeller marks on them. But there is a fix for all this with historical precedent. In 1995, the Mexican government, pressed by local activists, created the Cabo Pulmo National Park on the southeastern tip of Baja California, covering both land and a portion of the offshore region. Cabo Pulmo once saw much of the devastation that the rest of Baja California is suffering, but not anymore. Industrial fishing is prohibited, and ecotourism is heavily regulated. The result has been a 465% increase in the population and diversity of fish in the local waters and a recovery of the region's damaged coral reef. In 2005, Cabo Pulmo was named by the UN as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It became such a famous place, Mittermeier says. Now people are saying, oh, we need more Cabo Pulmos. Sea Legacy and Beta Diversidad, along with other environmentalists, are working to make that happen, leading a movement to create a protective zone that will fit like a sock over the southern half of Baja California, where the peninsula's greatest biodiversity is found, extending into the waters of the Gulf of California to the east of Baja and the Pacific Ocean to the west. Some sport and artisanal fishing will be allowed near the coasts and a tightly regulated ecotourism industry, but no industrial fishing. Farther out into the ocean will be a no-take zone that will leave part of the Pacific and Gulf of California entirely untouched. The tension really is to preserve the traditional way of life of fishermen and preserve the economic activity of tourism, but with a regulation framework so that it is not a free-for-all, says Mittermeier. Again, that abridged article was written by Jeffrey Kluger, with photographs by Christina Mittermeier. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.